The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Fake uniforms, surreptitious GPS trackers, torches to sever anchors, alcohol, prostitutes, even witch doctors. These are among the tools of the trade for a handful of repo men scouring ports and waterways around the globe. Often hired by banks, insurers, or ship owners, they operate in the ill-regulated, highly corrupt, and unfathomably vast seas, where each year tens of thousands of ships are stolen, impounded, or swindled, not by Somali pirates, but by white-collar buccaneers. Ian Urbina is investigative reporter for The New York Times. He's uncovered stories of slavery, summary executions, stealing, and selling organs, all taking place on the high seas. His most recent report is on maritime repo men. Ian Urbina, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So what a story. What kind of ships are these repo men, and they are all men in your story, hired to find?
So most often they're hired for a order of ship called tramp steamers, and these are typically older cargo ships. They're big, but they're not, you know, Captain Phillips style container ships. They're not the huge ones. And tramp steamers are a certain order of cargo ship that doesn't have a home port and kind of lives job by job, and typically are bouncing between second and third world countries, you know, moving foodstuffs or fuel or raw goods, computers, from one place to another. And those are the most vulnerable because they're going to ports that are notoriously corrupt, and they often don't have insurance, and sort of they're easy prey for scam artists.
So these repo guys that you spoke to, they get hired to negotiate or recover or extract. That's a term they use. Now, how often does it actually come to that?
Not often. You know, so the vast majority of repo work is kind of a ho-hum affair with, you know, paperwork and police who, you know, serve an order and it's carried out. And that's true the world over. A small subset are more entangled where there's some sort of complication. You know, maybe the person who is supposed to have their ship taken says, sure, yeah, I did damage your port, and I can't pay for it, so you can take my ship. But someone else gets involved, like the local dock where it's stuck, and says, wait, you can't take that ship because they owe me money. And then it gets entangled. And so these are sort of when it gets dodgy, and they fly in one of these, you know, extraction guys, you know, who are specialized in this. And step one is to try to negotiate, as one guy said, negotiate them back to planet Earth. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a million-dollar ship could be looking at a $50 million fine because the locals don't realize that's a ridiculous sum. And so the guy is flown in, and he has to sort of talk them back down to the reasonable realm. If he succeeds, then, you know, they pay it off and the ship gets on its way. If they fail, then the ship is still stuck, and that's when, as a last resort, an extraction occurs, which is sort of a waterborne jailbreak.
Well, tell us about some of these extractions. I mean, really sound dangerous for one thing, but also really challenging. You talked to Chris Meacham. He is based in Jacksonville, Florida, a maritime repo man. He and his team spirited hundreds of boats out of a marina in Mexico. How does this happen?
What these guys, you know, again, like you said, they're all guys that I spoke to, typically do is have a decided policy of never being armed and never using violence. So, you know, most of these guys also have an ethic of the crew are just sort of innocent middlemen, bystanders, if you will, and so they never do anything to harm the crew. That means if you're not going to use violence and weapons and intimidation, then you're going to have to use guile and kind of trickery. And so most of them do just that. They sort of go in, they do surveillance, they figure out kind of what the landscape looks like, quite literally. You know, can they get the vessel out? Or is it being blocked by other vessels? You know, how well guarded is it? Are there downtimes, you know, during shift change of the night watchman? All these sorts of things. And then they often hire locals, you know, prostitutes or street kids or bar owners or the like, to help them either do surveillance, which sometimes involves getting someone on the vessel to see if it has fuel, to see how many guards are on there. Is it even the right vessel? Sometimes these have been, you know, welded to look differently, painted over, etc., and you need to get to the engine room and check the serial numbers on the engine to make sure you're even looking at the vessel that you're supposed to recover.
So I guess that's where the costumes come in.
Yeah, you know, you can't make this stuff up. I mean, I would never have, maybe a better fiction writer than I would have thought this stuff up. But, you know, a lot of these guys have a closet of uniforms, sort of all-purpose uniforms, overalls, you know, royal blue overalls or gray overalls or whatnot. And they take some of them and they have business cards and they sort of size up the situation when they get in country and decide, you know, what ploy might work, if any ploy is needed. Sometimes it's basic, you know, you just watch and you realize there's a gap in the middle of the night when it's not, no one's watching, and they swim out and they climb on board and they start it up and they run. And they run to the 12, you know, is what they call it. The 12-mile line is the dividing line between national and international waters. And if you can get into international waters, then you're pretty much in good shape.
Ian Rubina is with us. He's an investigative reporter for The New York Times. And he's uncovered these stories of men hired to take back ships that have been stolen, docked, scrubbed to hide their identity by gun runners and human traffickers and even terrorists. Well, you spoke to a Haitian Coast Guard official who referred to them as vigilantes. So what's happening here? Is what they are doing legal?
No, I don't think it's legal. I don't think it's illegal. I think it's sort of extra legal, you know. You know, and I'm not trying to be Pollyanna, but I do believe that laws reside in country for the most part. There is international law, right? But most laws that apply to most of us in normal life are domestic, or they're national laws. And the laws that these guys are breaking are, from one perspective, real and exist, and they're local, they're national or even provincial, and they are breaking those. They're sort of taking matters into their own hands sometimes and not properly contacting the police and having them carried out, and maybe they're even going around a local judge who said that they're not allowed to take it. On the other hand, what these guys would argue is that they are breaking one law because another law has been broken, and that this is a fraudulent seizure, which is illegal. Even if it's legal in country, it's unethical. And if they can just get that vessel to another jurisdiction where there's a level playing field, again, I'm channeling them. This is what they would argue. And often they do. They take the ship, say, from Haiti to Barbados or a place, the Bahamas, where these are countries where there's more sympathy in the courts to banks and American interests, for example, than, say, Havana or Venezuela or Colombia or Jamaica. And so they take the ship there, and then they make their argument before a judge in those countries that their repossession was legitimate, and even if the Haitians or Colombians are not happy about it, you know, they want this judge in this country to decide the matter.
Ian Urbina, you are a reporter, as you pointed out, but if you were a Hollywood scriptwriter, is there one of these capers that you would love to write about?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most epic and dramatic one was one involving a guy named Max Hardberger, who's got, you know, a name that only a screenwriter could dream about, you know, and he's kind of an old hat in this line of work. He's been at it for a couple decades, and he's got a firm in New Orleans, and he's a sort of salty character who spends half his time in Haiti. And he had a job in Haiti some years back where, you know, it was dramatic because for a lot of reasons. Number one, he had to really employ some He hired a witch doctor to publicly put a curse on this one place in this really seedy port that I went to with him, which was the only place in town where you could get cell reception.
Uh-huh.
And so they put a curse there so that the police were too afraid to go to that field and call for help.
That worked?
It did. Well, no one called. Who knows whether it worked or whether no one thought to call, but no call went out to Port-au-Prince. But it was just, this whole repo, was one caper after another. They hired prostitutes to get on board and size up the engine room and the guards. And then as they left, the ship broke down. And so they barely made it to national waters. And it was really dodgy for a while. And finally, they got it running again. And they outrun these guys. And so it was the most dramatic. And I talked, these things sound like they can't be true, and you have to be skeptical. On that one, I dug pretty deep and got into court records and talked to other people in Haiti who witnessed or were involved with it from both sides of it, and verified it as a legitimate story. So that's the one that I would put on the silver screen.
Ian Urbina, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Ian Urbina, he's an investigative reporter for the New York Times, and you'll find a link to read some of the stories he has uncovered about human trafficking and slavery on shrimp boats and piracy on the high seas, including the photographs, terrific photographs, and full text of his most recent report, Maritime Repo Men, A Last Resort for Stolen Ships. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, the worst may be over for flooded St. Louis, but rising waters appear to be heading downstream and will likely reach Tennessee, Mississippi, and Louisiana in the upcoming days. While the havoc caused by surges in the Mississippi and Merrimack Rivers made headlines, historic flooding is becoming more and more commonplace in some areas of the country. So what's being done to prevent destructive flooding? Well, sometimes the best preparation comes from examining the scene after the waters have receded. Jenny Chen brings us the story.
We had 7 children and 4 adults in 2 cars and went to Estes for all the kids to have a good time and play.
It was the summer of 1976. Charlotte Yellig lived in Loveland, Colorado, and she had friends come in from out of town. This is why she suggested a trip to one of the most beautiful places in the state, Estes Park. But as Charlotte's family enjoyed a day of fun, a storm brewed above the peaks.
It started to rain, and we decided to take the kids and go eat pizza until it stopped. Well, it didn't stop. It just got progressively worse.
A perfect day was about to turn into a nightmare.
We walked outside, and the water was clear up over the curb and gutter. So we ran to the car, and my husband said, "We have to go home." And I'm thinking, how in the world can we go home? We can't even see the road. But little did we know how terrible it was.
Over 8 inches of water fell in the first hour. By the time the rain reached a canyon, it transformed into a torrent 19 feet high, strong enough to wash away 1,000-pound boulders.
10-4, can you call the sheriff's office in Fort Collins? We need the helicopter.
One of the worst natural disasters in Colorado history occurred last night.
News of the flash flood spread through Big Thompson Canyon west of Loveland.
The wall of water killed 145 people in the first 2 hours. Many wanted to believe that the flood of 1976 would fade into distant memory, that a flood like this couldn't happen again during their lifetimes. But 40 years later, it did.
No relief tonight from rapidly rising waters.
The Colorado landscape washing away as rescuers race to those trapped by rising waters.
A once in a 500 to a 1,000-year storm.
The flood of 2013 lasted for days. As much as 17 inches of water covered more than 200 miles. Though the water spread farther, this time only 10 people died in the flood. And part of that is because of engineers like Brian Varela and Stephen Humphrey.
Oh, I brought waters too, just in case.
Oh, nice, fancy.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a full service tour.
They are the engineers that work behind the scenes of every flood. As forensic hydrologists, Brian and Stephen study the havoc that floods leave behind, and then use that knowledge to stop future floods from turning into disasters.
So we're going to leave Loveland, and we're going to head up the Big Thompson River, through the canyon, which is U.S. Highway 34. And this is the road that connects the city of Loveland to the town of Estes Park.
Brian is driving down the same road that Charlotte took on her fateful trip to Estes Park. He and Stephen are taking me to see the places where the 2013 flood caused the most damage.
Are we coming up on the dam that was removed?
Yes.
20 minutes into our ride, the Big Thompson Canyon rises sharply on either side of us, both awe-inspiring and constricting. I can imagine water crashing down the rock face, and the thin road feels vulnerable.
You can see the cuts in the road, the difference in the color of the asphalt. It's another area where the entire roadway was cut out.
We get out of the car around mile marker 81. Brian points to a wall of rock on the other side of the river. I'm about to get a crash course in forensic hydrology.
What we look for right away is we look for any evidence of where the water was. We want to know if there's a high water mark on a tree or a rock wall, or there's a pile of leaves and sticks and branches that were left behind by the flood. We want to document that information.
Forensic hydrologists act like water detectives. They treat a flooded area like a crime scene, and they search for evidence that can tell them where the water came from and where it went. They get a little outside help, too. The U.S. Geological Survey monitors more than 7,000 stream gauges across the country. Stephen and Brian can draw real-time data from those gauges that can tell them how high and how fast water is flowing. But when those gauges fail, or the gauges just don't give enough information, that's when old-fashioned scientific sleuthing is required. And if you know what to look for, the landscape is full of clues.
Where the rocks were settled out, where that rock face was that the hillside was taken away by the river, and some of the trees and other vegetation that was knocked down by the waters, all three correlate to each other and create a picture of what that flood elevation or what that level looked like during the event.
Once they collect evidence out in the field, they input that data into computer models, which can map out how the water behaved and also predict how the water will flow in a future flood.
Usually, if you know the depth and the velocity of flow, you can break out more than 200 other behaviors like stream power, shear stress, a lot of other things that basically tell us how severe the storm can be, or how erosive it can be, or how big a rock is this river going to pick up and move. And then when it picks that rock up and moves it, where's it going to drop it off? All of those variables that come out of our hydraulic analysis, all those little pieces of information, tell a big story.
More and more people are moving to Colorado. In some areas near Big Thompson Canyon, the population has tripled in size.
As we develop more and more, we urbanize more and more, we have folks encroaching on the floodplain.
U.S. Geological Survey hydrologist Bob Holmes says this development is one factor that affects the intensity of floods.
We put the, you know, parking lots and we pave it and we have houses.
Things like concrete take away Mother Nature's ability to absorb water and slow it down.
Not only does it not allow it to infiltrate, but it puts the water coming off the watershed much more rapidly. So it increases the time for the flooding to occur. It becomes much more rapid in its occurrence and onset.
But Colorado is not alone. In states across the U.S., people are encroaching on floodplains in areas previously untouched by human infrastructure. As the floods affect larger numbers of people, the damage they can inflict becomes more destructive, which is why hydrology work is so important. Using the hydrology data, states can decide whether the risks of future floods outweigh the costs to rebuild.
The states try to get rid of these repetitive loss locations. You know, there's places that have been flooded four or five times.
For some of these places, Holmes says the best option is not to rebuild. But that can be a difficult reality to face for people who have claimed a flood-prone area as their home. On our drive back down from Estes Park, Brian points out a sign for a shop called Indian Village. But the actual shop is nowhere to be seen. The store survived the 1976 flood with a bit of damage, but it was completely wiped out in the 2013 flood. Brian says it's a story that has repeated itself over and over again for more than a century.
But you look back 150 years, people walked into an area and said, this looks great. Let's build here. Let's grow food here. Let's make this our home. They didn't realize the risk around them from flood hazards. The first settlers of eastward movement or westward movement came in, put down their camp, and the Native Americans that were there warned them, hey, you probably don't want to build there. And they ignored them. And they were flooded. And then they rebuilt and they were flooded again.
Brian and Stephen hope that their work can help close this loop. The hydrology data will help the town of Estes Park not just rebuild, but rebuild smarter. As my tour of the Big Thompson Canyon winds to an end, Brian says that can only happen if people actually act on the data he and Stephen collect.
A lot of times people collect information, they put it away. We got some good photos, we got high watermarks. All right, our job here is done, back to work. And I think if you don't take that history and do something with it, then you're going to suffer the same consequences the next time around.
For residents in Colorado, there are years of work left in the rebuilding process, and they are preparing for the inevitable, yet another flood. But next time, with a little help from hydrology, their communities hope to be more prepared and more resilient to the powerful force of water. This story was produced by Jenny Chen and Ellen Rolfes for the STEM Story Project, distributed by PRX and made possible with funds from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. An estimated 45 to 50 million workplace drug tests are administered each year in the U.S. For many American workers, passing random drug tests is a condition of employment, from factory floors to Fortune 500 companies. The ACLU found a 277% rise in workforce urine, hair, and oral fluids testing since 1987. And lawmakers in several states are discussing testing applicants for welfare, job training, and nutrition assistance. Daniel Engber is a columnist for Slate. He's never had to take a drug test, but he looked into the cost, efficacy, and privacy questions raised by random drug testing and found very little evidence of its success. Daniel Engber, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
So in your cover story, you look through the history and present of drug testing in America. First, where and when did drug screening start?
Well, I mean, there are two questions, I guess. One is, when did drug screening of any kind started? And that really kind of took off after the Vietnam War. And it was used to help with the rehabilitation of drug-addicted veterans. But in the way we understand it now is kind of this widespread workplace screening program. That's a product of the 1980s.
So it became policy for federal workers under President Reagan during that war on drugs era in the 80s. But you point to a disaster in the private sector that set off what you call the national binge on drug testing. What happened?
Yeah, well, one of the big events was in January of 1987, and it was an Amtrak disaster outside of Baltimore. More than a dozen people died. Hundreds of people were injured. And it turned out that a railroad engineer named Ricky Gates admitted eventually that he had taken three hits off of a joint while driving a train that was partially responsible for the accident, although there were other causes that were identified. There were safety signals that had been tampered with, totally unrelated to Gates's drug use. And this really, I mean, the drug testing trend was already in full swing. But once that happened, it just sort of went into overdrive, I guess.
Well, for your article, you talked to a number of critics, and you raise a number of interesting questions about the efficacy of testing. So first, what do random drug tests reveal about use and impairment?
Well, they don't tell you anything about impairment on the job. These are not tests. I apologize for
that's okay.
That sound.
Can you want to say that again?
First of all, they don't tell you anything about impairment on the job. These are not tests of whether someone is, you know, high on cocaine or stoned when they take the test. Of course, these are tests of whether one has used drugs somewhat recently. And for the urine tests, I think it's a matter of a few days to a week. So, I mean, that's one of the problems that critics have identified with this. It doesn't tell you if your workers are the sorts of people who are going to be impaired while they're working. It tells you perhaps what they do on the weekend or what they do in the evenings when they're not at work. So it just raises this question about how relevant is this really to the all of the stated goals of drug testing, which is to make a safer, more productive workforce?
How about whether or not the tests reveal alcohol use and what we know about how alcohol can alter performance at work?
Yeah, I mean, that's these tests, generally speaking, so we have 50 million of these drug tests a year in the U.S., according to the testing industry. A small proportion of those are look at alcohol use, and that's only in special sectors of the economy, long-haul trucking, for example, transportation people, professionals. But for the rest of us, it's generally they just look for illegal drug use, and by far the most common is marijuana. And so you really have no idea if, you know, your prospective employees might be alcohol abusers, might be alcoholics. Whereas we know that alcohol abuse, you know, could be just as dangerous or more dangerous than marijuana or many other drugs. And it could be also have a greater effect on productivity than those other drugs. And we also know that alcohol abuse is far more common. I mean, I added up the numbers from the National Institute on Drug Abuse and found that there's twice as many alcohol abusers. This isn't just drinkers. These are people who are classified as having a real problem with alcohol. Twice as many of those as all abusers of all other drugs combined. So there's just this weird disconnect between what we're testing for and what the reality is in terms of quote-unquote abuse of drugs in America.
And of course, this opens up the prospect now that marijuana use is legal in some states, whether or not there's a distinction between illegal drugs and legally used drugs in drug testing.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's kind of what got me interested in the story to begin with, that there's, you know, we're seeing this kind of schizophrenia in the U.S. About the war on drugs. So we're legalizing marijuana, we're rolling back some of the most egregious overreaches of the war on drugs. Three strikes laws are, I think, there's talk of repealing them in different places in different ways. And yet for all of that, this widespread pre-employment drug screening seems to be, as you know, going as strong as ever.
Random drug testing of employees has been a growth industry since it was introduced nearly 30 years ago. And my guest, Daniel Engber, a columnist for Slate, looked into the practice and determined it's not so much a thoughtful labor policy as just a compulsive habit. Well, Daniel, you found very little evidence, and as we're hearing, that routine employee drug testing has a solid base of proof that it succeeds. So what is success in this case?
Well, I mean, first of all, I want to say, I want to use a cliche and say that the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. And just because there has never been any solid peer-reviewed research proving across the board that these programs increase productivity or improve safety in the workplace doesn't mean that it's not true. And that's one of the tricky things here. So a lot of the data that one could use in theory is proprietary. I mean, these are private, a lot of this is private companies doing the testing, and they may not be interested in sharing with economists or public health experts the outcomes of these drug tests and their rate of accidents on the job. So it may be that we just don't know. On the other hand, I would say if there were a huge effect here, if there were a major effect in improving safety and productivity, maybe you'd be likely to see it. But it's hard to say. So it's something I had to be careful with in writing the piece, that when I say that there's no evidence that it works, that doesn't necessarily mean that it doesn't work. It just means, you know, we should be asking a lot of questions, because this is an invasion of privacy in some ways. It costs a lot of money. It takes time. It's an imposition. So, you know, given that we don't know for sure what it's doing, we should be careful.
Well, I admit that, like you, I have never worked for a company that did random drug testing, which, after reading your article, made me feel, you know, kind of out of touch and kind of lucky, because this feels invasive to me, you know, your bodily fluids being property on some level of your employer. How do people feel about being tested?
Well, I mean, there are even some disturbing studies that show that when you control for all different variables, African-American men, I think, are more likely to be drug tested than other members of other demographics. So, you know, that's certainly, if it already makes you feel targeted and singled out, then there may be some racial bias in who's getting tested. I mean, it's awful. It really is. On the other hand, you might have the companies saying something like, well, I mean, this is often used in support of drug testing. Okay, maybe it doesn't actually increase safety or improve productivity, but it's not that hard to pass a drug test. All you have to do is, let's say, not smoke marijuana for 5 days. And, you know, whether you agree that marijuana should be illegal or not, why not just abstain for 5 days? If you can't do that, that says something about your character, and maybe you're not someone that this company wants to hire. So, you know, there are all these sort of secondary reasons why maybe drug testing would be useful for businesses, but I agree. I mean, it just seems like the personal impact is, I don't know if it's worth it.
Well, Daniel Engber, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
Daniel Engber is a columnist for Slate, and you can find a link to read his column, Why Do Employers Still Routinely Drug Test Workers? The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The 2001 film A Beautiful Mind recounted the mostly true story of John Nash, who endured paranoid schizophrenia and delusions and went on to win the Nobel Prize in Economics. The movie won 4 Oscars, including Best Picture, and was considered a coup among advocates for more visibility of mental illness on screen. Julie Kliegman, freelance journalist and The Week's weekend editor, observes a shift in how mental illness is now being treated on the small screen. Whereas crime procedurals often connected psychosis with violence and disorders like OCD as tools for fighting crime, this year brought more compassionate, nuanced depictions of mental disorders, including this one from an anthropomorphized horse.
I guess my question is, do you think it's too late for me?
What?
I mean, am I just doomed to be the person that I am, the person in that book? I mean, it's not too late for me, is it? It's not too late. Diane, I need you to tell me that it's not too late.
Bojack, I
need you to tell me that I'm a good person. I know that I can be selfish and narcissistic and self-destructive, but underneath all that, deep down, I'm a good person, and I need you to tell me that I'm good. Diane?
That is a clip from BoJack Horseman, one of the shows Julie highlights in an article called 2015 was the year mental illness finally got some respect on TV. That article was originally written for Vulture, and we found it on Slate. And Julie, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
So we just played that clip from BoJack Horseman. What makes that representation of mental illness good?
Sure. I think there are a lot of factors there. One is that BoJack is a main character in the show, which is something we see a lot of recently with portraying mental illness on screen. But if you go a little bit farther back into depictions, you see a lot of very short story arcs, very minor characters that have these mental illnesses, which kind of sidelines the issue. But with BoJack, everything with his depression and his substance abuse is really front and center. And, you know, the show is funny. It's depression doesn't have to be super serious. It doesn't have to look the same way every day. And I think with BoJack, we can empathize with his struggle. We can also see that he's maybe not the best person in the world, or the best horse, sorry. But I think we see that in a way that doesn't imply he makes poor decisions solely because of his depression. I mean, he has some other character flaws going on there. I think that's pretty clear.
So what are some of the other accurate representations, or what you'd call accurate, that came up this year on TV?
I think one of the most impressive ones is You're the Worst, and that's Stephen Fox's show. It's in its second season, and the depression plotline was new this year. And what that did a really good job of doing was showing the monotony of depression, which can be a really hard thing to portray on TV. A lot of people, when they're depressed, they're very stationary. They sleep a lot, or they, you know, lie awake a lot. They don't want to go out. We see a lot of Gretchen hiding under blankets, but they do it in a way that's funny and that it works, and that it really shows the tension in her relationship on the show. other than that, I'd say Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which, by the way, the name is totally tongue-in-cheek. It's not meant to be stigmatizing with the word crazy. We see Andre on Empire struggle with bipolar disorder. Pick any show. A lot of them have portrayals of mental illness in main characters, and it seems like more and more they're sensitive and a little bit more accurate.
So 2015 is not the first time that mental illness has been compassionately portrayed on TV. What are some of the early examples, the front runners, so to speak?
Sure. So I think one of the really, really early representations that did something sensitive and accurate was The Sopranos, where we see this tough protagonist in the very early 2000s. He's seeing his therapist. He struggles with anxiety, and it's front and center in a way you wouldn't expect it to necessarily be in that kind of show. So that was one of the really early front runners, and that was around the same time that A Beautiful Mind came out. So I think that makes sense.
You mentioned one researcher who said that they're pretty much waiting for a Will and Grace moment in terms of portraying mental illness on TV, meaning acceptance of making a gay character a main character on a TV sitcom. Have we come anywhere close to that kind of turning point, Julie?
It's really hard to say. One of the interesting things about researching mental health on TV is that it's hard to find solid data on where we are. And that's because it's hard for people who research stigma and mental illness to get funding for this type of work. So what we come across usually is there was a study from the 90s. There have been some others that look at different characters with different mental illness on TV and sometimes how viewers react to them. But that's not something we have a lot of recent information on. So it's sort of hard to track our progress in any sort of quantitative way. But I think we're definitely building to a certain moment, and you can tell there's a ways to go, and nothing's ever going to be perfect. Certainly Will and Grace, I think everyone can agree, was not perfect. But yeah, I do think we're building toward some positive change here.
Julie Kliegman is a freelance journalist and The Week's weekend editor, and she's been observing a shift in how mental illness is now treated on television, on network TV, on cable, and on streaming service shows. So you did talk to some writers and actors who are trying to take some steps to better portray mental illness. How are they doing it?
I think there are a couple of key things here. One of them is a lot of these writers are working off personal experience. I mentioned Crazy Ex-Girlfriend earlier. Rachel Bloom, who co-created that show and also stars in it as Rebecca Bunch, she has personal experience with obsessive thoughts, with anxiety, with depression, and that's something she's really learned to mine for humor and also, you know, use for good storytelling. And I think, you know, everyone always says, write what you know. She's writing what she knows. So that's one factor, is really going off what you know personally. And the other thing that's really important is when you don't know something, what a lot of show creators and writers and actors are doing right now is they're talking to people who do have firsthand experience, as well as experts who can give them more factual information, more scientific background.
That will help create a more accurate portrayal of mental illness and its effects. And there's a show that I thought of, Homeland. Now, this is like Monk, seems to treat the main character's bipolar disorder as a sort of superpower. Here's a clip.
The meds have saved my life, literally. But something is lost, too.
The elation.
It's more than that. There's this window when you've got all that crazy energy, but you're still lucid. You're still making sense. And that's always when I did my best work.
Mm-hmm.
I took down a major insurgent network in Iraq. I stopped an attack on the State Department in D.C.
You want to go off your meds now? Is that what you're saying, to figure this out?
No.
No?
I've already gone off them 3 days ago.
So, Julie, that's Claire Danes playing Carrie Matheson, who is a CIA agent or former CIA agent. It's almost a central point to her character that she has bipolar disorder. And there we hear her sort of like managing it. You know, is there a kind of damage in that kind of portrayal of mental illness, do you think?
I think there can be. I think a character like Carrie at certain times can maybe unintentionally sort of encourage people with mental illness to not seek the treatment they need for fear that they might lose other characteristics about themselves, characteristics that make them successful at their jobs or in their friendships, when in reality there's, you know, getting treatment is important, whether that comes in the form of medication or therapy or both. And, you know, I think the other thing is that it can sort of send the message to the general public that people like Carrie, you know, the people with mental illness who at times are very high functioning and very talented and extraordinary are the only ones worthy of help or love and support, when in reality, everyone with a mental illness, no matter, you know, how they come off or how successful they are, or how talented they are, is worthy of the same treatment and support.
There are even some critically acclaimed shows like Mr. Robot, which has been, you know, on top of a lot of top 10 lists for 2015, that have received some criticism about how mental illness is featured on the show. Now, why was this show singled out?
Well, first of all, I think Mr. Robot drew a lot of criticism, first and foremost, because it was one of the most talked about shows of 2015, and it did a lot of really interesting things with its storytelling. So in some ways, I think we're talking about it just because it succeeded in grabbing everyone's attention and telling really compelling stories. That said, I think with the mental health plot line, and, you know, there's plenty of room to disagree on this, and we can't say where Mr. Robot might go in the future, how that would change the show's sort of take on mental health. But, you know, when I watched Mr. Robot and when one of the experts I called watched Mr. Robot, it becomes kind of apparent that Elliot, the central character, he, you know, we see him in therapy at various points throughout the first season. But what we don't see is a really clear diagnosis for him. And so we're watching him have these hallucinations and do some extraordinary things, both dangerous and incredibly intelligent at the same time. And we don't really have an explanation for how all of his symptoms fit together. And so it sort of seems that Elliot could be mentally ill as more of a plot device as opposed to a way of making a statement about mental illness, which is okay. I mean, not every creator has a statement on every issue. But yeah, it sort of seems like Mr. Robot leans toward perpetuating stigma rather than clearing it up.
There are a lot of people who point out that the U.S. is in the middle of a mental health crisis. Do you think now showrunners have a responsibility to be accurate or in portraying mental illness or to use it as more than just a plot point?
Well, I'll say this. At the end of the day, with any show, the creator and the writers and the actors, the creative freedom is all theirs. No one is telling anybody how to definitively entertain someone or what is right and wrong. And, you know, there's so much gray area that that'd be impossible to try and do anyway. But I do think people in the entertainment industry have a responsibility to consider what storylines they're writing and how those will be perceived, and not only perceived, but internalized by viewers. I mean, I think a sort of cynical thing to say would be, oh, well, it's just TV, it doesn't really matter. But, you know, I think no, like we care deeply about television and we do take lessons from that, whether we mean to or not. So I think, you know, there's a lot of room for middle ground and for things that maybe aren't 100% accurate, but get the gist of what's going on. And I think it's important to think about how you portray mental illness and whether you could be hurting fans of your show with what you're doing.
Well, Julie, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Julie Kliegman, she's a freelance journalist and also The Week's weekend editor. She wrote about how mental illness is now being portrayed on TV for Vulture. You'll find a link to read her article at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also listen to the show anytime with the Word of Mouth podcast. You find it by searching Word of Mouth, NHPR, and iTunes. And do us a favor, if you like the podcast, please rate it on iTunes. It'll help others find it and has the added bonus of traveling by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.